Welcome to Four or Fewer, films by directors who have made four or fewer films.
Well done.
Featured by, or presented by, rather, the Brad Pitt cast.
We're still the Brad Pitt cast. We are
the Umbrella Corporation.
Exactly. It's like Google being owned by Alphabet. Brad Pitt cast is the overarching company name. We are Four or Fewer.
Yeah, my subsidiary.
Exactly. Where we're looking at the films of Scottish director Lynn Ramsay, one by one. And as I said to you before we hit play on Morven Keller, the crazy thing about a four or fewer structure means that we're now halfway through Lynn Ramsay's filmography. Cards on the table. We are here to talk about Morven Keller, which is my favourite Lynn Ramsay film.
Oh, interesting. See, I don't know if I knew that.
And one of my favourite films.
Incredible.
I first saw this film when I was 14 upon the recommendation of my father. Have I spoken about my father's habit of recommending wildly inappropriate films?
I think you might have brought it up.
My dad, when I was 13,
so crazy,
saw that I was getting into cinema and was like, you know what? You'd really like this film called The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover.
My parents hate that film, by the way.
Do they? Because it's so grotesque. Yeah. And that film contains not only explicit sex, but sexual assault, horrible scenes of violence.
Yeah, and also just, I might have seen a bit of it. I definitely haven't seen the whole thing, but it's quite a sadistic film.
It's cruel, it's evil. The film director,
like, Greenaway is a...
He's a sadist.
Yeah, I got a bad vibe.
That's why he's one of my favourite filmmakers. Ari Aster, the director of Hereditary and Midsommar, called The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover a film that hates humanity.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. So yeah, my dad would not supervise these watches. He also really told me that I'd like the film The War Zone. Do you know anything about that film? Directed by Tim Roth. It's about incest. It's just straight up about a brother and a sister who have sex, and they have sex with their dad, and there's awful murders.
It's weird that he would say, Joseph, you, my teenage son, would like this. Like, not just... Because I think there are levels of parents being, like, okay with watching.
Mm.
And, like, you know, various styles of parenting. Parents were okay with their children watching pretty horrific stuff. But being encouraging is just so fascinating to me. And your father doesn't seem like the kind of person who would... I don't know.
He doesn't seem like the kind of person who would either enjoy these films or be to his teenage son, like, go ahead and go and watch them.
Yeah.
It's still baffling to me. I'll have to talk to him about it.
Mm.
And yeah, he burnt me a DVD copy of Morven Keller because he was so sure that I would like it. So somewhere in boxes of possessions, I have Morven Keller with his handwriting scribbled over the top in permanent marker. And Morven Keller was, in a way, a respite from the uglier films that he showed me, because Morven Keller is maybe a cruel film? Do you think this is a cruel film?
I don't think... I have a pretty sensitive antennae for cruel films. I don't know if it is, because I think it's quite sympathetic to its main character, who's having a tough time.
Although she doesn't really show it or express it in any conventional way whatsoever. Yes.
But I think that's okay, because I don't think it hates its audience. I don't think it ever wants its audience to suffer in any inordinate way. It wants its audience to acknowledge the suffering, even if it's not conventional suffering, of the person on screen, of the protagonist.
Morven behaves in an extremely bizarre way, but I think it's depicted as being somewhat acceptable. There's a sense in which the film gives her the leeway to do what she does.
This scene would probably be a pretty easy four-sentence game.
I think you could do it in a single sentence.
Morven Keller comes home to her boyfriend having committed suicide, so goes on a bender and then to Spain with her best friend. Oh, and discovers her boyfriend's unwritten novel manuscript with which he has left instructions to send to publishers, which she does, but replaces his name with hers and is awarded a very lucrative publishing contract.
Yeah, that's it. It's basically a plotless film.
Yeah.
There's a very, very small spurring action, which is, as you say, the boyfriend committing suicide and the hunt for a home for the novel. But that happens in a way that, like, things fall into place without Morven having to do anything.
Yeah, there are numerous points in the film where you think it's going to kind of stretch out. For example, she never really reveals to anyone that her boyfriend has killed himself, to the extent which she takes the body and buries it.
Cuts it up,
cleans after notably leaving it on the floor for several days, seemingly. not touching it. Obviously someone who is undergoing a traumatic experience, but she doesn't want to tell anyone that her boyfriend has killed himself. She just kind of says to her best friend, oh, he's gone away, and is kind of vague about it. It feels like if the best friend had been more understanding and asked better questions, perhaps she'd have revealed it.
She says at one point when they're sitting in a field towards in Spain, the end, yeah. she says he's dead, and the friend thinks that she's being ridiculous and goes yeah. like, what are you talking about?
Well, almost doesn't even... it's the way in which sometimes you'll say something in conversation and the other person's halfway through a thought, so like, maybe understands that you said something but doesn't really assimilate it because her friend's mad with her at the time. And it's one of the Samantha Morton, is that, that's the actress who plays Morven Keller, kind of spends a lot of the film in a dissociated seeming state, but when she says he's dead, it's one of the few times her voice kind of like cuts through.
Yeah.
And it seems like her a more lucid self is appearing, but the friend just doesn't hear it.
And that's interesting because, as I think you were talking about, it's like you think that maybe this will go somewhere in terms of the plot.
Yeah, I think that's because you could imagine a film around like, oh no, she's hiding the body and is she going to be found out or when will she reveal it? But that stuff is not the stuff of the plot. The same with like, there's various people they encounter on the journey. I guess you could say the book is the most central because the book contract is like a guiding plot force in some ways. But
you never find out anything about the book whatsoever.
And there's also not really any obstacles. Like, it kind of just works. Like, she is worried that... She sends off the book. She has to let it saying we're interested. She's in Spain, but she, like, still tells the publisher, like, oh, you can meet me here. And they fly out and meet her there and offer her a big contract. And she accepts it with some anxiety. And then she gets the check.
Yeah.
Like, there's no... you could do a lot with that plot. Like, you could create a lot of tension around that that is not really... that Ramsey doesn't seem to care about. And no. The film doesn't really care about.
She doesn't care about tension at all. There's no real conflict in this film whatsoever.
No. Even to the extent where she leaves her best friend in Spain by the side of the road, and then 10 minutes later in the film, towards the end of the film, like in the final sequence, basically, she's talking to a friend again in a bar, and like they don't deal with that her having left her could be a source of tension. It just isn't.
Yeah. There's even... I mean, there's so many films that this could have been, and one of the things that this film could have been is a road trip film, right? If I told you, this is a film about a woman who is trying to sell this manuscript, her boyfriend has left her a cassette tape, a mixtape that he made for her, and you could easily make a movie about going
Thelma
from...
Thelma and Louise.
Yeah, exactly. Two young women going from publishing house to publishing house, listening to the music. And in fact, even this mixtape, which could be such a cohesive hook, is only occasionally played.
Yeah, there is a really extraordinary bit of sound editing or mixing or whatever. I don't know which Oscar would be awarded for this. Where there is a song playing as part of the non-diegetic soundtrack. Mm. And then, I always forget which is which. Diegetic is part of the film, right?
Yeah.
And it then transitions seamlessly into the kind of tinny...
Mm-hmm.
audio of the Walkman, which Morven has, and it happens to like the film ends with that, and it happens like two or three times before it. It's just so simple, but it works so well, and it works really well because you kind of are, as an audience member, you are shifted within kind of different internal spaces of Morven, so it kind of like shifts you into her experience and the kind of tinniness and insufficiency of reality out of the kind of grandeur of the film soundtrack.
Yeah, because the film, we've said the ways that the film doesn't have all these tensions, but if it has any kind of tension, it's that you know something awful has happened to Morven.
Yeah.
You've seen it. Her boyfriend's committed suicide. Yeah. And the tension of the film is we think we know what those internal processes of dealing with someone's suicide will be, and the film just doesn't let us inside.
Yeah.
Morven never really verbalizes anything. I mean, the whole point is that she's keeping the suicide a secret. But she never lashes out. There's no scene of explosion, really, whatsoever. She talks the most in the scene with the publishers. And even then, she's lying, basically. She's trying to claim this thing. So she's always obscured. She's always obfuscated. She's just this... central mystery. So playing around with this sound of going like, it's almost like a tease.
Yeah.
We know what Morven looks like from the outside, and the only glimpse we get of the inside is when we hear the music as we would be hearing it.
Yes.
If we were her. Which is fascinating, and which makes this, I think, the most distinct film in Lynn Ramsey's filmography. Mm. Because Ramsey, as we talked about last time, is obsessed with subjective experiences. You Were Never Really Here as a film that deliberately, constantly puts you in the head of the main character. It's following his train of thoughts. There's, like, sudden flashes that operate like intrusive thoughts. There's disassociative, scattered thinking, jumping from image to image. Whereas in this, there's nothing. It's basically, the whole film is Samantha Morton's silent face, which is extremely notable for its blankness. Morton never shows any kind of real emotion, and she has a perfect face for this kind of neutral, switched-off processing.
Yeah. There's a scene where she is in a hotel in Spain and gets locked out of her room and goes into, sleeps with... She just knocks on someone's door, and the guy says, my mother has just died. Is that someone we've seen before? That guy's open. So she just knocks on what might be a random door, what might be someone she knows.
I think we're strongly suggested that it's just a completely random door.
Yeah. And then there's a kind of montage-y sequence where that's quite intense, where they have sex. But there's this moment where when it shifts to the montage, she's wearing this face that is somewhere in between, impossible to tell whether she's... And this, I'm sure this would have been the instruction that Lynn Ramsey gave, because it seems quite intentionally ambiguous. Impossible to tell whether she is, like, bursting into tears or...
Laughing hysterically. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There's just... It's a psychological study of someone who has a blank or neutral psychological state. It's like a study of disassociation, I think, in a really important way. You're just looking at this character, and you're constantly thinking, like... Well, you know, this crazy thing just fucking happened to her. She should be feeling this. She should be doing this. And instead, she constantly subverts what you would expect of her. It reminds me, this film, I think, sits in a canon of three films, one of which you've seen in addition to Morven Keller, and the other which you haven't seen, about women having something traumatic happen to them who then resist the normal ways we think of responding to trauma.
Yeah.
The other one is Fat Girl, the Catherine Breillat film, which you've seen, which is similarly kind of plotless. It does almost an inverse thing to Morven Keller. It's this character who's completely blank. Yeah, the film is her on holiday with her sister, and then something...
The last... Oh my gosh.
Out of nowhere, like another film has beamed in. Something stupendously awful happens to her, and her reaction is a non-reaction.
Yeah.
And the third
which
film...
Which is kind of... In some ways, Morven Keller in reverse, right? Because you get the story of the person who might react in that way to this scene.
In Fat Girl. Yeah, and in this you get someone reacting just in a way that you wouldn't think.
I haven't thought about that film in a while. That last scene is in my head.
Yeah, the last scene is... I'm going to push the mic closer to you.
Oh, sure. I can lean in.
There you go. You know what? I'm leaving that in the edit. Yeah. I love the little moments where...
Behind the scenes, folks.
Where I tell you to keep your fucking hands off the table or don't kick the fucking table. Whatever I tell you. The third film that also does that, which is a film that I would highly recommend, is a film called Holiday by a filmmaker called Isabella Eklof. That is...
All films directed by women.
Yes. And I want to say something about that in a minute. I think it's real significant. Holiday is about a wife of a drug dealer going on holiday to Spain, so a lot of Morven Keller in there, to whom several awful things happen, and who responds in exactly the inverse way that you would expect in a very shocking final scene. And I think it's notable, as you say, that these are three films made by women, because I think they are... I don't think... We said last time that Lynn Ramsey is not a film director with any kind of messaging at her heart. But I think if Morven Keller has anything like a message, it's resisting traditional notions of victimhood. This is a film about someone who could be a victim, who could act like a victim. And we would still say that she has been victimized. Her boyfriend has done something shocking, selfish, and cruel to her. It's fucking Christmas when he kills himself.
Yeah.
And he does so where she'll find him. He gives her all this work to do.
He's like, I've left money for the funeral. Send this book to my publisher. It's also like, obviously, suicide in itself is not necessarily a selfish action.
No.
But there is suggestion also that his previous Like, his past behaviour has not been great.
Yeah, they talk about him. Someone asks her, oh, was he in one of his moods again?
Yeah.
It's also significant that he's a blank. The manuscript is a blank and he's a blank.
Yeah.
We meet him when he's dead on the floor.
What's the manuscript called again? Something End? Or, like...
Do we even get the title?
I think...
I'm not sure we do.
Okay. I thought there was like... Oh, no, sorry. Maybe it just says read this or something on the screen and it doesn't actually say the title. And I just... Yeah, unless that's the title, which would also be... But I don't think it is. I think you're right. We don't...
Yeah. There's a sense in which there are these gaps right in the center of where we would most want to know what's going on.
I already feel like I'm losing some of it because it's quite a dreamlike film and I feel like there's a bunch of visually really striking stuff and very interesting visual decisions that I'm kind of losing my grip on a little bit, even though we literally just watched it together and walked upstairs to record the podcast.
I think it's because it's... You would say that Ramsay is usually restrained, I think. She's not a very show-offy filmmaker.
No.
But this is so fucking restrained. This is like... You can barely see her making any authorial moves at all. The one shot which kind of draws attention to itself as a shot is... Morven Keller is leading... the two publishers around this graveyard, and there's a sequence in which she takes a rose, puts it behind her ear, the camera pans further down the graveyard, you lose track of Morven, and then it continues to pan and she's there, so it's like she's appeared
left to right, and she's still, which is, and it's not an all the way around, it's like a physically impossible shot.
It must have required Samantha Morton to walk behind the camera and then appear at another spot. And that's really the only sequence where Ramsay shows her hand. She's so dialed back in this film.
There are some sequences in... Yeah, I just remembered. There's this odd cut early on. So she goes to meet her friend after she discovers the body of her boyfriend. The best friend who is like a key foil throughout the rest of the film.
Lana.
And she, then they go to a party. They go to a pub and then they go to a party. And then they go to... like an outdoor fire, and there's this extraordinary scene with this boatman
mm-hmm.
who has this torch and is shining it, and I wasn't even sure if it was Morven, but it I think is it Morven. Is and he shines the spotlight on her and she just kind of lifts her dress up
to
show her underwear and then puts her dress back down.
It's horror movie stuff.
It reminded me a bit of
Night of the Hunter. Yeah, what, a lake in a kind of river at dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a cut disguised in the movement of the fisherman's lantern. So he shines it on Morven, he pulls it away, there's a cut, and when he shines back on her, she's in a completely different position.
Yeah.
Extremely jump scare adjacent.
Yes, it's a creepy film, but never quite... There's, like, the Running with the Bulls sequence when they go to Spain. I guess, is it Pamplona?
Yeah.
And so, like, they approach, like, Morven drags Lana to this place without really telling her what they're doing in this kind of weird, like, with this weird cab driver. And then one of the first pieces of evidence of, like, life in this town they're coming to is this little kid in a mask, which I guess is part of the ceremony around Running with the Bulls. Which I said to Tristan, who we watched the film with.
My housemate. Shout out to Tristan.
Yeah. It reminded me of The Wicker Man, that sequence.
Yeah.
Like the Christopher Lee, the original one. Well, I haven't seen the other one.
It's not very good. Surprise. It has Nicolas Cage shouting about bees.
Yeah, famously. But it deeply unsettled me.
It's an unsettling film, but as you say, there's nothing... Because there's nothing non-naturalistic in it, there's nothing specific that you can point to.
Yes.
I think what's creepy...
There's not even, like, last time we had The Mouse to the Moon... In Ratcatcher, there's nothing like that, I don't think.
No, there's no reality-breaking sequence except for, say, Morven showing her underwear to the fisherman.
Which is
completely compatible with a realistic film.
It is out of time, though, because there's, like, she's around the campfire, and then it cuts to that and cuts back to the campfire, where she still is, I think.
Yeah.
So there is some playing with that kind of stuff. But there's also, there was a, like, because we watched, because we watched Ratcatcher recently, there's this scene where on the morning after the party it cuts to a shot of Morven sitting by the side of a lake, and I was like, oh, this seems like it might turn into a scene similar to the boy in Ratcatcher running through the fields of wheat. But then her friend turns up and in a magnificently economical bit of dialogue, Morven says that's the island on which my foster mother is buried,
yeah,
which is a great, like,
Yeah. You know, and that's perfect. It.
Yeah.
You think that there's going to be more. At another point, Morven brings up her foster mother again with the guy yeah. in the hotel. She says, do you want me to tell you about my foster mother's funeral? Yeah. And then again, cut. Which is the thing, right? Is this resistance to victimhood. Morven's, we understand yeah. that maybe Morven's story could be a sob story. She had a foster mother. At one point when she's talking to the publishers, she says, oh, I like writing because it means that you're not, you know, counting mm-hmm. down the years until retirement. You're not living like an empty pension, life.
Yeah.
Which is, we know, is what Morven is actually self-describing her own life through yeah. this fiction. But she never acts. It's never a sob story. You're never emotionally manipulated in any way whatsoever. You're just constantly reflecting on the neutrality, the emptiness, which I think is what makes it a really lonely film.
There's that great scene in the supermarket when she enters it. And at first, you kind of are led to think that she's just shopping there, but then you turns out she works there. A really excellent soundtrack. And there's like a song turned all the way up, and it's shot in such a way that it like defamiliarizes the supermarket, and it feels very alien and strange and large and kind of like too fluorescent lit, and it's beautiful
but sad
but extraordinarily tragic. Yeah,
I wanted to, because it's close to me, I've been thinking
literally
it's physically close to me. I've been thinking a lot about this Philip Larkin poem recently, which I think is one of my favourite.
Read it out.
I'm going to read a section of it, because I think it describes what this film is about.
I got that.
Do you?
Yeah, I do.
Fuck, Larkin's the best. It's a shame he was a terrible person, racist.
Real bad guy.
A terrible misogynist. Just the absolute fucking pits.
Yeah, mean.
Mean. Worked as a librarian, wrote horrible letters about everybody he ever worked with, was an absolute prick, yeah. and wrote some of the most beautiful poems ever written. In fact, can I read an unrelated Larkin sure. poem that's really short? This one's just called Days. Do you know this poem?
I think so, yeah.
What are days for? Days are where we live. They come, they wake us, time and time over. They are happy to be in. Where can we live but days? Ah, solving that question brings the priest and the doctor in their long coats, running over the fields.
It's very good.
Just the fucking best. Great.
Yeah, that's an excellent poem.
Yeah, running over the fields.
Yeah, and their long coats. Both have long coats. Yeah. Maggie Jane, I love that poem.
I love it so much. This is the Larkin poem that I think is relevant, and I think even the title is deeply relevant to Morven Keller. It's called The Life with a Hole in It, and the middle section goes like this. Life is an immobile, locked, three-handed struggle between your wants, the world's for you, and worse, the unbeatable slow machine that brings you what you'll get. Blocked, they strain around a hollow stasis of havings to, fear, faces. Days sift down it constantly. Years. So this idea of like life is a locked struggle between these forces of what you want, what the world wants for you, and what you're actually going to get, feel deeply intertwined with Morven Keller. Yeah.
And resistance to that, right?
Yeah.
The specific struggle that Larkin refers to, that it's not just those things colliding. You are... It is, by its very nature, frictional.
Yeah. There's this sense of tension between Morven's dreams and also how the world fulfills her dreams in, like, a very strange elliptical way.
Yeah.
When we were watching it, it is kind of one of the funniest things about this not very funny film. Mm-hmm. In fact, are there any jokes at all?
Maybe some visual kind of...
When she enters the supermarket, there's a sweeping shot through the supermarket in which you're following an old woman in, like, a motor scooter, which is reasonably funny.
But Ramsay's not cracking up behind the camera.
No. Is Lynn Ramsay ever cracking up?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
She might be... Because I normally find humorlessness pretty unforgivable, but I wonder if it just works for her. Because she's so... You just know she does have a very dark, good sense of humour. It's just that she doesn't need to bring it to bear in her films, perhaps. The Mouse is pretty funny, I guess.
And we need to talk about Kevin is very funny. Because Kevin is a comically shitty child. He's just the worst child ever. He's worse. I would easily... I mean, he does that too. But I would easily father Damien from The Omen over Kevin. There's a sequence. We'll talk about it.
Bring it up.
I watched it yesterday with friend of the podcast, Xavier. We watched We Need to Talk About Kevin together. So I'm really in Ramsay mode at the moment. And there's a sequence in which Kevin, who's just been a shitbag the whole way through in every imaginable way, he, like, wears his nappies till he's, like, 7 years old and, like, insists on getting his mother to clean up his shit. He's just the absolute fucking worst. And there's this sequence where she's trying to get him to count and he's resisting to tell her the next number. And he's just sitting there snapping crayons, just, like, going through a bowl of crayons and just snapping them. I'm like, this is the worst child anyone has ever had. My review of We Need to Talk About Kevin on Letterboxd was just, that kid has some problems, which I think he definitely does. But yeah, that's a very funny film. Okay. But this is, yeah, as you say, almost entirely humorless.
Oh, there's the scene with the two British... Like, when they come to Spain, there's two British tourists that think that Lana and
Morven
are foreigners of some kind and try to, like, speak to them as if, patronizingly, as if they were foreigners, and then they pretend to be foreigners. And that's, like, there's the kind of... And there's another set of British guys that they encounter, I think, in a bathroom, telling them about, like, some great club that they've got to go to. Just the kind of what I could imagine as one of the worst possible experiences, which is ending up in a Western European seaside town inundated with British tourists.
That latter sequence, though, is undercut. The humor in that is undercut because there's a woman, like, leaning against the wall, having, like, some kind
makeup.
Some kind of drug experience with her eyes, like, rolling into the back of her head, filmed in extreme close-up. That's genuinely very disturbing.
Yeah, there's a bit of that. None of it is laugh out loud, certainly.
Yeah, you wouldn't... If I recommended you Morven Keller and I was like, you'll have a fucking laugh riot.
Comedy is not one of the Netflix tags on this film.
Can you imagine stumbling across Morven Keller on Netflix? Presumably people are just shutting it off within, like, 3 minutes, right?
It's because it opens with a bloodied corpse on the floor.
And it's slow.
But it's not... It doesn't acknowledge... It doesn't give you any... I was thinking, actually, while watching this, that, like, it is interesting that this and Iron Man exist in the same medium.
Yeah.
That's... Or just Marvel, the Avengers, say. That was, like, on my mind.
Lynn Ramsey has said in an interview, no one's asked me to make a Batman film, but I could do it. I'd be good at it.
It's true.
And so maybe she will one day bridge this gap that seeing.
I guess all superheroes have some latent trauma, but I think Batman specifically, like, makes sense for Ramsay, right? Seeing your parents murdered when you're a child.
A long-lasting trauma, which all of her films are about trauma in a really deep way. No one's asked
me.
I know. Can you imagine being the Marvel person who watches Morven Keller and being like, you know what? Get Lynn on the phone. Although, there's this...
Yeah, you could conceivably watch You Were Never Really Here and be like, we want to take someone gritty. We want to, you know, make a gritty Green Lantern.
Let's get Lynn. There's a crazy story from Robert Eggers, the director of The Vvitch and The Lighthouse. Have you seen both of those?
I've only seen The Vvitch.
Yeah, I think you'd really like The Lighthouse. Okay. It's funny.
I like those. I like Pattinson and Dafoe.
They're an incredible two-hander in that film.
I feel
film.
Like everyone I talked to... I feel like I was looking forward to that film, and then everyone I talked to was like, it was pretty good. I was like, oh, okay.
It's not mind-meltingly great. If you've seen the trailer, or if you've heard someone say it's like about two people going crazy in a lighthouse...
That's just the...
You know the film.
Yeah, sure.
There's nothing further to it. I watched Brandon Cronenberg's Possessor the other day.
Oh, yeah.
And Possessor is similarly a film with, like, a really cool idea. It's about people swapping into other bodies. And then it kind of just does the idea. It plays it out in 90 minutes. And it's just ever so slightly underwhelming.
Another thing I've been thinking about lately is how much pressure there is to be surprising in order to be spoken about these days. I think, you can't just be someone who's an expert in their craft. You need to be, like... You need to have something that is... Like, I feel like in the way people talk about The Witch, they talk about... Or The Vvitch.
Please.
They talk about, like, Black Phillip, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's this thing in it that's weird and unsettling. And apart from... Like, it also... I think that's a really great film. But Black Phillip is the goat with the devil inside him, probably.
Who says, wouldst thou like to live deliciously?
Yeah, a good film.
An incredible line.
Really good line. That... if you don't have that in your film, or yeah, I think there is something about like
you need a surprising.
Yeah, everyone is M. Night Shyamalan these days. If you want to be known,
it's the meme culture. Yeah,
exactly.
Right?
That's what like Black Phillip is a meme, right?
Yeah, you have to have something that can be turned into a meme
that people can water cooler conversation.
Yeah, I bring up Eggers to say he tells this crazy story that the Vuvuzela won an award at the Sundance Film Festival, like Best Newcomer, and Marvel got on the phone to Eggers' agent without having seen the Vuvuzela, because it wasn't in a release that they could have seen it. So they just merely heard that he'd won this award, and they were like, get him to come in. Which tells you of something of the...
Yeah.
Maybe this is an obscene word to use in this context, but the predatory nature of the Marvel...
Machine.
Which now has this formula of... You take very young, no-budget indie directors who you can completely push around, and you make them make your big multi-dollar, multi-million-dollar movie. Yeah, completely wild.
Have you seen the stuff about how... I'm talking about Marvel, so fucking boring, but have you seen the stuff about how all their fight scenes are just sequenced and shot, like,
basically... Many years before.
Yeah, like, they just know exactly how they're gonna go. Because I think there was a director who was told... Don't worry about the fight scenes. And she was like, well, I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah. Lucretia Martel, right. Yeah. Which is crazy because she is the kind of filmmaker that you would probably say, don't worry about the fight sequence. She's never made a film with anything resembling a fight sequence in it ever before. But yeah, that's why they look like shit. That's why they're always they big like CGI.
Because
they're
CGI people who have organized them, not actual filmmakers.
Exactly. So yeah, Lynn Ramsey could probably make...
She could
make... Well, because I would think about it more and more, and Joker is such a Lynn Ramsey film.
Yeah.
There are so many elements.
Social work, trauma.
Trauma, the rats, violence. the strikes, the garbage strikes that open the Joker are exactly the same.
Can I catch up?
Yeah, yeah. It's incredible. Todd Phillips just...
Joaquin Phoenix,
exactly. Todd Phillips just watched Lynn Ramsey's filmography and was like, you know what? Let's do that, but
the
with
King
the
of
Joker.
Comedy. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Joker, good film. The Brad Pitt cast, pro-Joker.
Some of it.
You like
I thought it was
Joker.
Fine.
That's pro. I'm shooting up devil horns.
Yeah, sure.
Because we're now the podcast of Edgelords.
I watched it all. That's our banner.
I have to quickly, while I remember it, say, if you listened to our last Ratcatcher episode, you would have heard the sounds of Lynn the Pug.
Oh, boy.
Running around like an absolute small machine designed with the express purpose of irritating me. Lynn is no longer with us. That makes it sound like she's died. She's not died.
Yeah.
A pug rescue company got in touch and took her off my hands.
Good luck to them.
Imagine
how many snorts there must be in that pug rescue company.
imagine walking down the aisle of pugs and just being overwhelmed by a cacophony of snorts. Yeah, truly, truly ridiculous to have that creature in my life. I now have a different foster dog.
That sat next to me through the entirety of Morven Kala, mostly sleeping, licked my leg once, but aside from that was as quiet as you could possibly imagine a dog to be. Really difficult to tell whether the dog... Because the dog was also sitting in that location when I arrived.
Yeah, it didn't move.
And I sat next to him, and he was just perfectly happy to be scratched for 90 minutes.
Yeah, he came to
literally
us...
Literally hasn't moved since I... entered the house.
No.
But seemed quite happy. Like, not in a invalid way, just in a like, chilling way.
He came to us with the name Fritz. I have renamed him John because there's no creature I've ever met more with an old man energy. Yeah. His moustache, he has this fur above his lip that is all tan-coloured that looks precisely like a nicotine-stained moustache.
He's very sweet.
He reminds me of the protagonist of the novel Stoner.
Oh, yeah.
Just one of those people who, like, slips out of time, is not noticed by anyone, is just asleep in the corner. So, yeah, Lynn has moved on to happier pastures with fellow pug brethren, with all of her medical cares needs being completely taken care of.
We love that for Lynn.
So... sorry to everyone who tuned into the Ratcatcher episode, decided that they were obsessed only with Lynn the Pug,
you know what,
and
I
will
just,
now
sorry.
Stop listening.
You know what I just realised? The name of that pug you renamed Lynn, this has been renamed John. And if we do another four or fewer, It will be...
Oh, shit.
Jonathan Glazer.
Jonathan Glazer. So we've got
a theme going.
Yeah.
Renaming foster animals.
After the directors that we're going to cover on For All Viewer. Are we doing Glazer next? We got to do Glazer next. I think we have to
now. It's predicted by the dog.
Fucking Jonathan Glazer. What a king.
With this, actually, speaking of Jonathan Glazer, and partially this is just because we're in, like, rainy Scotland, but this did remind me a bit of Under the Skin. Mm. Also, like a woman who is...
completely blank.
A blank slate to some extent.
Yeah, true. I mean,
if it, one is in Under the Skins because she is an alien.
In this, because she's traumatized.
Yeah.
I just think, what did you think of Morven Keller?
I thought it was extraordinary. It's, so, it might be the film, I'm trying to think of films that I have watched knowing less about in the last few years. Thinking back through the Brad Pitt cast, maybe True Romance, I knew very little about, maybe the maybe California, I might know it was about a serial killer, but I didn't know much about them, I think. And then both films were kind of like vague, you know, like I guess gangster film anyway, but like kind of vague plot lines. But it was really fascinating watching it, having literally, this could have been about anything. I mean, I presume Morven Keller was the name of a person. But aside from that, I had zero data, and that it was directed by Lynn Ramsey. It was a disorienting experience, and I'm not sure how much of that was my lack of information going in, because I was never sure how long it would spend somewhere. If going to Spain was a real left turn, and the fact that they stayed, like, I wasn't sure if, like, well, we just get the Spanish airport and then they're back home, mm-hmm. or. But it was, they really commit to the Spain. That, so I found it very disorienting. But I think you, when I had told you before that I didn't know anything about it, you encouraged that I continue not to know anything about it, and I think this is a film that makes sense to not know much about, because specifically because it is resisting the conventional response to an extremely traumatic event, you are very aware of what your expectations are in relation to that event, both in terms of how one would react in real life and also how films tend to deal with these things. And to have them constantly kind of subverted, or like to feel like constantly unbalanced, but it's beautiful. The acting is impeccable. I don't know if it, I would have to watch it again. I mean, you say it's one of your favourite films. I wouldn't say it's one of my favourite films, but I would also say it's as good a film as it could be for what it does. I think I would probably have to watch it again and be, I mean, you obviously saw it at a formative time, which would shape it for you, but B, I would also have to, I don't know if it's in my wheelhouse of the kinds of films that I love, but I also was totally transfixed by it and thought it was an extraordinary piece of filmmaking. It's really good.
What would you give it out of 5 stars? No, I'm mostly joking. I just like idea of hearing you eloquently explain your precise and then just being like, listen, Dan, just give me a fucking number of stars.
Rod, yeah.
I can't process anything unless I'm processing stars.
Maybe 4.5.
Yeah, incredible. Did you like it more than Ratcatcher?
Yes.
Hmm.
Maybe that's because it wasn't underscored by constant pug snorting, which really did not stop throughout the entirety of Ratcatcher.
No.
But I also just felt it was more... like, Ratcatcher is a really... I think films about specifically poor childhoods in the United Kingdom are just not very enjoyable.
No.
Like, to refer back to Susie Craze, who's a fan of the show, friend of the show, Grid, by which we talked about last time, I think, yeah, which has like masterpiece of a film and like how much you actually enjoy, like enjoyment. I can't remember the exact criteria, but like, do you enjoy watching it and is it a good film? Basically, are the two criteria. And I think Ratcatcher, obviously a great film that I'm just not having a very good time, apart from when the mouse is going to the moon. And I think I'm having a much better time. Yeah, a very transfixing film. And also just such incredible, like, performances. And, like, just so interesting to watch. Like, visually very interesting.
Yeah.
That scene when she's in, like, she comes out into the... even, like, you walk out into the corridor of your hotel and the door locks behind you for Morven. She doesn't even react to that as she should. Like, that's a very upsetting situation. She just knocks on someone's door, goes in and sleeps with them.
Yeah.
But the scene where she's kind of in the corridor... I mean, hotel corridors are so great. I'm obsessed with aesthetically with hotel corridors. I think they're just wonderful. And there's so much potential in filmmaking in that kind of, like, weird liminal space that is also just extraordinarily visually striking because of, like, kind of length and symmetry and everything. And also, like, beigeness. And it's just that is such a striking scene. And then also in this kind of cemetery with all this like whitewashed stone, where you get some similar shots. Yeah, it's good. It's a great film.
Yeah. It's interesting too, you mentioned that Morven Keller doesn't react to getting locked out of her hotel room as you would expect. A really interesting thing that the film does is, because it begins with the suicide, the first scene is Morven lying there, hugging her boyfriend with the Christmas lights flashing. You have no sense whatsoever what Morven Keller was like before the traumatizing event. No one ever refers to it. Yeah, it's
not just her boyfriend, right? That's true.
There's no sense. It could be possible that she is just this way.
Well, there is. So when she meets Lana on the street after she's left her house, like, for the first time, Lana is like, what's gotten into you? And for, like, half a second, there's like, take this pill.
Yeah.
And then they get high. And so there is this sense that, like, I mean, obvious, and she is, like, being a bit reticent and obviously is upset and distressed to some extent. But you're right. Like, aside from that kind of, like, what's up, there's no sense of what kind of shift of character has occurred.
There's just holes in the film everywhere. There's gaps. It's a gap-filled project. Gap in the main character's interior life, gap in the center of the narrative. It's just this sense of, you're living a lonely life. You're living a life with something not there. It's pivotal, I think, the line of dialogue that maybe in some ways seems most like a thesis statement is after Morven gets this massive advance from the publisher and is preparing to pack her bags and go overseas again.
She says
to Lana, come with me, come on, let's go. Don't worry about money. And Lana goes, it's the same crapness everywhere, wherever you go. And I think it's interesting to decide whether the film thinks that's true or not.
Yes.
Because Morven seems to have had a good time in Spain. Now she's got a fuckload of money. That seems pretty good. So it's interesting whether the film is completely ambivalent in the way that it's ambivalent on everything.
Yeah.
Is Morven going to have a new life? What's she going to do with the money? Is it going to make her happy? The film kind of shrugs its shoulders.
I think one of my favourite things about this film, and I think the way in which it is kind of artistically inspirational, in both inspired and inspiring, is exemplified in the scene where, like, early on, the way you discover the main character's name, aside from it being the title of the film, is that she's sitting at a train station and a public phone rings and she answers it and they're like, and you only hear her side of the conversation, but she gives her name and I think spells it.
She does spell the beginning of it.
And then nothing, like, and then she, like, has a little conversation that cuts before the end. The film cuts before the conversation ends, which is, I just love that so much, that a film is willing to be like, how do we get, and it's not, it doesn't even feel mechanical, but it's like, okay, how do we get this person to say their name? We don't have someone calling them by their name. We have them sitting in a train station for no, like, we don't know why they're at the train station. And there's just some, like, there is a call, they decide to answer the phone, they give their name, and then that's not returned to.
Yeah.
It's so smart. And so much of the film is like, why can't we just do the thing?
Yeah.
Like, let's just, we don't need to explain this. This is not, it doesn't matter who the boyfriend was. Or if it does, but it never feels lazy.
No.
Which is that's the elegance of it. Because you can imagine something that, like, the, you know, a lot of the worst, I think, people who read David Foster Wallace and think that they can just put stream of consciousness on paper and it will be good writing, or people who read, like, you know, fragmented free verse stuff and think, like, oh, I can just, you know, there's no need for structure. That kind of art. I mean, the worst thing about the shift in painting from the figurative to the abstract is that it just opened the door for every charlatan who wanted to get in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you can just we can skip the rules. But Ramsay skips the rules without it being, while keeping it grounded in reality and keeping it grounded in meaningfulness.
In meaningfulness, I think, is important. Every decision she makes has some kind of purpose, even if in the case of this film, the purpose is ambiguity.
Yeah.
Like, it's a film deliberately constructed to be as ambiguous as possible. And so all the decisions line up on top of that ambiguity.
Yeah.
I think it's an extraordinary film.
I agree.
I think it has an extraordinary performance at its center. Samantha Morton is so good. She's amazing. And I just think it's, as you say, one of my other favorite films of all time is David Cronenberg's Crash. And Crash and Morven Keller are similar in my mind because they're two films that set out to do what they want to do and do them so mechanistically, so perfectly, that there's just no other way to tell the story of Morven Keller. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Every other version of this film sucks.
Platonic. Yeah.
This is the platonic ideal of how to make a film called Morven Keller.
Which is interesting because it's based on a novel, and I'm really interested to see how much... Because you can imagine with a novel... There's not necessarily, I mean, there's ways around it, but do you think there'd be some more access to Morven's inner life?
Maybe it's third person. I've never read the novel.
But I wonder how much liberty Lynn Ramsey took with it.
I think she takes a lot of liberty. She's famous for basically making it up as she goes along.
Yeah.
We need to talk about Kevin is actually a pretty strict adaptation. But even then, she cuts out all the stuff that she's not interested in. We'll deal with it next time. There's like a pivotal moment in the book that she just completely ignores.
I haven't read the book.
Book's pretty good. Letterboxd game. How you feeling, Dan?
I'm doing all right. I'm a little bit beleaguered by life, but more or less pretty good. Things are traveling along. Tired, I think.
Yeah, often I'm tired too. It's the change in seasons. It's the change in the clocks.
The change in seasons has really like disoriented me. I think I'm not, as a Brisbane boy, I am still daylight savings and the sudden like chill in the air is just not something, even though I've lived in Sydney for 7 years now, it's not something I'm used to. Because in Brisbane, there's like two seasons. And I think it's still like, it requires some getting used to.
Yeah, but I fucking love it.
Oh yeah, no, I want just any excuse to put on a coat.
Whoa.
What do we got for rating? Should I guess?
Oh yeah, do guess. This is, I don't even know if I should read that. Guess the average.
3.4.
I'm making a face. Keep guessing.
3.8.
Yes! Well done.
It's in the all in the face.
Yeah.
If listeners think that he stuck his fingers up or something, he did not.
No, I just had a 3.8 face on my face.
That's what you get from doing however many episodes of a podcast.
Yeah, you too. If you record 700 episodes of a podcast with a friend, you too will be able to read ratings off their face. One of my favorite lines from Hereditary is, "And now you're staring at me with that face on your face."
Yeah.
Tony Collette.
Good show.
Should we do a low rating one?
Yeah, let's do a low and then finish with highs.
This person has an interesting top four. 2001 A Space Odyssey. We talk about it all the time. It's
good. Yeah.
It would be a better movie if it was just the stuff about HAL. Sure. HAL 9000 or whatever he's called. The computer.
Big baby.
The big computer who tries to kill people. On the Silver Globe.
No, never heard of it.
So it's a 1988 film directed by the director of Possession, which is one of my favorite films. Yeah. I've never seen it. It's 165 minutes long.
Oh boy.
So almost 3 hours. The plot line is just a small group of cosmic explorers leave Earth to find freedom and start a new civilization. And I've just heard it's a very, very tough watch.
Huh.
So as much as I love Possession, I just think it's unlikely that my life is long enough to fit in a 3-hour, very difficult film to watch. Sometimes you just got to be honest about what you can take on, your load, your carrying load.
Capacity.
Exactly. I take load from Safe. You know, in the Todd Haynes' film Safe, there's a lot of talk about, that's, you know, everyone's carrying a load. Yeah. What's your load?
A great film.
Let's just do a one-off episode on Safe.
I would like to watch it again.
Just a perfect film. This person's third favorite film, The Immigrants. Never heard of it. And fourth favorite...
It's not a Haneke film, is it?
No. Jan Trowell.
Oh, okay. No.
A Swedish filmmaker. It's his most watched film on Letterboxd. Sure. I've never fucking heard of it. And fourth favorite, Swallowtail Butterfly. Also never heard of it.
What does this person think of Morven Keller?
So this is a 1-star review that starts with, "Interesting watch." So just bizarre. "But overall a bad movie and definitely Lynn's worst. The main character always feels scripted and never natural.
That's not true.
She maybe doesn't feel natural, but there's a reason why she doesn't feel natural. She's meant to be mechanized.
Yeah.
This is what we call disassociation. This is what it looks like. Oh. And the rest of the movie somehow mixes up. I'm not going to read this slur out. It's a slur about having a lot of sex.
Oh.
With discovering oneself, which is a mistake that's been thoroughly repeated over and over since, but at least some movies seem to make fun of the trope.
Don't like that. It's not a tropey film.
No.
These are not things that are functioning as tropes, they're just things that are happening in the film.
No. This movie's fatal flaw, sadly, is that it is absolute hipster trash, pandering to that very specific audience and ignoring all that is good about storytelling, filmmaking, or even art in general, in the pursuit of uniqueness.
It's funny, like, sometimes there'll be these reviews accusing a thing we have watched and maybe somewhat liked of, like, pretentiousness. And sometimes they're grounded, and sometimes they're just, like, wildly wrong.
Yeah.
And this, to me, is just baffling.
Yeah, I guess pretentious because it's slow. I think that's what people...
And ambiguous, yeah. I think.
I'll give you one more one-star and then a five-star. This person doesn't have a top four, but their last four films are 1.5 stars for Star Wars The Last Jedi. Ridiculous take. 4 stars for A Ghost Story. Ridiculous take.
Oh, wait, The Last Jedi is the Rian Johnson one.
Yeah, The Last Jedi is the best Star Wars film by far. 4 stars for A Ghost Story. That movie can go fuck itself. Okay. I hate A Ghost Story. They loved A Cure for Wellness.
Frodo, Bilbo in it, right? The Ghost Story, is that right? No. Or am I thinking of something else?
It's got Casey Affleck.
Oh, I'm thinking of... Anyway, yeah.
What are you thinking
of? I don't know.
Martin
Freeman.
Yeah, that movie fucking kicks ass. Okay, that movie's great. That's Ghost Stories.
Oh, well, not that crazy that I would confuse them.
No, that movie's incredible. Okay. It's based on a Broadway play that I saw in the UK and had the best time with.
Okay.
They loved A Cure for Wellness, which is great.
Okay.
Gore Verbinski film. And they loved Kong Skull Island, which I've said it before, I'll say it again.
You love King Kong.
No, I'd fuck King Kong.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, you love Godzilla.
I love Godzilla. So sorry. What the hell? I made
that mistake.
You do that many episodes of a podcast that you can read a rating off my face, but you can't remember that I'm Godzilla all fucking Team King Godzilla. Kong.
Yeah, of course.
Whenever I see a movie that I don't like, I usually just pass it off and move on with my life. However, Morven Keller is one of the few movies that I straight up hate. The main character is a loathsome... Oh, God... I've just got to proof these further. The same slur is used again.
That's wild. I didn't even...
Letterboxd, a den of iniquity sometimes.
So, I thought we were past that. As a society.
The main character is a loathsome, wretched, unsympathetic, unemotional, and completely unrelatable. Just not going to say the word. The story has plot holes in the first third... Plot holes?
It's a... Bond film.
Yeah, exactly. What plot is there to have holes in it? The night party scenes overstay their welcome and became nightmarish flash fests.
That's the point.
And overall, I can't think of anything I like about it. It's one of the worst movies, comma, I've ever seen in my life.
Good one.
5-star review?
Yeah, please.
Someone just said this movie is so boring. I can kind of understand that.
That is the most relatable, because it is...
It stretches your patience quite deliberately. It has its own rhythm.
And doesn't satisfy you deliberately as well.
No. So you fall into the rhythm or you don't. Yeah. And if you don't, then that's just part of it. Lynn Ramsey's films are like paintings. Still just breathtakingly perfect in every way. Okay. Anna Nappi. This person's top four films. Good top four films.
Mm-hmm.
May. Have you seen that?
No.
Retelling of the Frankenstein story.
Fun.
It kicks ass. David Cronenberg's Crash. 5-star perfect
you
film.
You love it.
Trust by Hal Hartley. Have you seen any
Hal Hartley? These are all single-syllable films. No.
They are. Hal Hartley's really good. Underrated American indie director from around the same time as Jim Jarmusch.
I think you've told me that I would like his stuff.
I think you'd really like it. He made a film called Henry Fool, which I think you'd really like, about a garbage man who writes poetry.
Yeah.
Highly recommended. And this person's fourth favorite film, Little Otik, which is a really good horror film by the stop-motion animator Jan Svankmajer, which is about these people who can't have a child, so they get this log and they pretend the log is a child, and then the log comes to life.
Great.
Completely grotesque.
More Frankenstein.
Yeah, really beautiful. This person's review. A spellbinding and visceral journey through the complexities of loss. I was speechless after the opening scene, and by the final shot, my mind was completely under the heels of Samantha Morton's performance. and Lynn Ramsey's mesmerizing direction. From pulsating Christmas bulbs to music playing in and out of Morvan's headphones, the technical brilliance of using poetic lighting and multiple sound sources is breathtaking here. It's beautiful and thoughtful and real on every level.
Wonderful. Correct.
Brilliant love. What a good laugh, mate. And sad tale in it. That's one whole review.
I agree.
I guess that does that.
Yeah.
One of the greatest soundtracks. Wow, the ending gave me chills. I think the ending is superb. It's Morvan. I keep almost calling her Lynn. It's Morvan in a club listening to Dedicated to the One I Love while there's strobes going off around her.
Yeah.
It's really good. Someone just reviewed Fuck. Let me give one more substantial one. Batshit plotline. Is it a batshit plotline?
No, it's not really a plotline. I mean, the Spain stuff is funny.
Okay, this person's top four films. Oh, pretty interesting. Center Jenny, which is a 2013 documentary, which I haven't seen. All the Real Girls, directed by David Gordon Green, who was the indie filmmaker who started making, like, Seth Rogen comedies.
That's right.
Nowhere, the Greg Araki film, which is really good.
Mm.
Greg Araki, you once confused Nowhere for Nowhere Boy, the story about the young Lennon, on this very podcast. And Streetwise, a documentary about homeless teenagers from the 80s, which everyone says is incredible. This person's review is just unbelievable how a sepia filter and some quality sound design will always make me say, God, I wish I were here without fail.
Pretty good stuff.
Morvan Keller.
Morvan Keller.
Fucking kicks ass.
Yeah, it's a great film. Well done. Lynn Ramsey.
we should end every episode with either congratulations or thumbs down sent directly to David Fincher.
Yeah.
Next week, next time, maybe next week, who the fuck knows? I always cut out when I accidentally say next week, but let's leave it in just to see. Next week, we'll be talking about...
We need to talk about Kevin.
When I watched We Need to Talk About Kevin yesterday with Xavier, he made a series of really great We Need to Talk About Kevin jokes. He was like, I can't see anyone talking about Kevin yet. Which actually turns out there's limited We Need to Talk About Kevin.
I just quickly want to, before we wrap, give a shout out to Desi,
mm-hmm.
a dedicated listener and someone I know, who gave us some lovely compliments in a recent email, but also said that... as I've been listening to episodes back to back, he's been listening to the back catalogue, bless him, more I'm noticing how often Joseph says a movie might be the worst movie ever made, and how often he says Dan would love that movie. A lot. Since Joseph is a journalist and Dan an academic, I don't know about this, Desi. You both might already know or have Google Pinpoint, but if not, you should check it out. You can input all the audio from the episodes, and it scans and makes transcripts of it. Then you can search for phrases, and it'll show you every time you say it. If that works, we should do it.
We should do it. That would be extremely funny. Am I referring to the same film?
That's a good question.
I think not.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd recommend... Yeah. I often tell you, you would love that.
I think that's what he means.
Two phrases.
Yeah, two just phrases, recurring phrases.
Thanks, Desi.
Anyway, thank you so much. And, the Brad Pitt cast and four or fewer combined, we send you our best.
We always do.
Yeah. All our listeners.
Send us an email.
TheBradPittCast@gmail.com.
Follow us on Twitter.
@BradPittCast.
And send us an email. Tell us what you're thinking about Lynn Ramsey.
Are you enjoying four or fewer? Is there another director that we could perhaps talk about?
Xavier was guessing some of the directors might cover yesterday. So guess some of the directors. Yeah. It's a fun game. Who do you think we would cover?
Had some chats. Wonderful to speak to you all. I don't know what I'm doing.
What the fuck are you doing? Dan's in like a green armchair. You look very kind of dignified.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing either. We need to talk about Kevin, based on the best-selling book by Lionel Shriver.
We look forward to it. This has been a short problematic person. In tribute to Lynn Ramsey's extremely short films.
Yeah, 90 minutes, every one. Yeah, Morven, don't take the fact that we only recorded an hour on Morven Calla to think that there's not a lot in there.
Please watch it.
It's incredible. Yeah. Go and watch Morven Calla, and then watch We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Yes.
In preparation for the next time we will hear from you.
See you then.
See you then.